Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. This is one of those mornings when we're going to be transported to a far and distant land. We're going to meet fascinating people, real and fictional, including a world boomerang champion and Senator Patrick Leahy. But we start in the late 18th century or 19th century, Tsarist Russia. It was a time and place that was extremely hard for Jews and women. Vermont author Michael Fried Thal takes us there in his new novel, Horodno Burning. You'll find yourself learning about vodka making, the literature at the time, shtetls, and the wave of Jewish immigrants to America. Joining us now to talk about his book is Michael Fried Thal. Michael, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Glad to be here.
It's great having you. Now, listeners, if you've got a question for Michael about his book, or if you've read it and care to comment, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Michael, describe this place, Horodno.
Well, Horodno is based on a real town called Grodno. Today it's quite large. I think it's over 300,000 people, and it's in the country of Belarus, which has been in the news lately. But back at the time I was writing, it was a much smaller town, 25,000 people, probably 60% Jewish. And the Jews called the town Horodno, which was their Yiddish version of Grodno. Mm-hmm. So it was basically between a river and eventually a railroad line, which spurred some industrial growth. It was a town that was a crossroads of invasions and cultures, and it had no natural defenses. So, as you can imagine, it changed hands quite frequently. In its early stages, it was part of what was called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And then beginning in about 1791, Poland had been weakened by a number of internal struggles. And the neighboring powers, of course, took advantage of this, Russia being one of them, Austria and Prussia being the other two. And they, over a period of some years, they carved up that large Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and basically made it part of their empires. And Russia took by far the largest piece. So all the Jews who had lived in towns like Horodno and in Poland and Lithuania suddenly became within the Russian Empire. And this this alarmed Russian merchants who didn't want that competition. So they urged Tsar Catherine the Great to do something about it, and her response was to create what eventually became known as the Pale of Settlement. Originally, I think it was called the Area for the Permanent Settlement of the Jews, but that's not quite as literary. So I'm glad that I could use the Pale of Settlement. Yeah. And it was the area where Jews were allowed to live, which basically included most of all of modern-day Lithuania, Belarus, I think Moldova, a good chunk of Ukraine, I'd say the majority of Ukraine, a slice of Latvia and Russia. And if I've left anything out, I apologize.
Well, Michael, give us an overview of the story in Horodno Burning.
Sure. It's basically a love story, although I didn't necessarily start out that way. I started out thinking I wanted to write about Jewish history, but in the development of the characters, one is a bibliophile, Esther, known as Estes in the book, and she basically is very resentful that the boys get to go to school. She doesn't. She has a brilliant mind, and she lives for books. And the other protagonist is a religious boy, Bernard, and he hides a secret, terrible secret, because he can't read, which is almost a crime in the Jewish community. So they're an unlikely couple. And so the question I think that emerges naturally in the course of the book is, you know, is love enough to transcend differences in education, politics, and religion? Because he's very religious and she is not.
Right.
I'd say that's, in a nutshell, there's certainly other currents that run through the book.
It's set in a very specific place and time in history. Why did you choose this? Why is this important to you?
Well, I don't know if I chose it or it chose me.
Yeah.
I started out probably like a lot of writers, thinking I was writing one book and ending up with another. In my case, it was a pretty dramatic switch because I started out wanting to write a memoir of my mother's side of the family, because my dad's family was from Brooklyn. They were all very extroverted, extremely politically on the left side of things involved, from Brooklyn. So, and my mom's family lived in rural Pennsylvania in a small town called Clymer, and I knew much less about them. And they had come from Lithuania, Vilnius, and Hrodno. So as I was writing, I got pulled into this fascinating 19th century history. I realized I wasn't a memoirist. I like to tell stories. I like to, use my imagination when I'm writing. So I just decided to turn the very few tidbits I had about my mother's side of the family, embellish it and turn it into a novel. So that's how that got going.
It doesn't read like someone's first novel. What was your career before writing?
Before I started this book, I had been a principal for a number of years, and before that, a teacher. I worked as a carpenter. I think to be a writer, it helps to have had some life experience. Although, I think there are exceptions to that. You look at Emily Dickinson and the poetry she wrote, and I don't know if she ever left her, but
right.
But imagination can take you pretty far, and in her case, genius.
Right. Well, how was being part of the Burlington Writers Workshop, how did that help you develop your skill as a writer?
Well, in terms of that was very foundational because I really didn't know if I could write before I joined that group. I had never published any. Well, I had maybe as a principal, I had certainly written things that got in newspapers and so on. But in terms of story, I had never published a short story or novel. And the feedback I got there gave me the confidence that I could write, and giving feedback to others gave me the confidence that I could interpret things and give valid feedback, which is also very helpful for writers to read other writers' work. It was definitely foundational for me.
What is it you enjoy about writing?
In terms of this novel, particularly, since the pandemic, I guess I was into the editing stage by then for sure. But even before that, I mean, things have not been great, in our country. It's been a while since I think we've been able to say, gee, things are going pretty well. And I think other than getting an airplane and going to another place and changing your scenery, I think reading about other places and other times and writing about them is like getting away.
Yep.
So it took me away from our current strife and divisions and gave me a view of another fascinating period of time. It made me also think that in some ways our times aren't as bad as we make them out to be.
Right.
That things that I'm glad are part of the 19th century and not our 21st century. So there's that as well.
And it does. The book takes you away, like I said, you know, back to the 19th century, to a place you would never have traveled to a time, to meeting people. And for me, learning about the Jewish culture throughout the book that I had no real concept of. So it really does transform you and take you away from the current day. Michael, this era of Tsarist Russia never meant much to me other than the fact that it did lead to the overthrow of that system and the eventual rise of communism in Russia. But what were the conditions like in the book, you know, in that late 19th century period that you write about for the Jewish people?
Okay, I'm going to try and be brief.
Yeah, because I'm also going to ask you about for women as well, because, okay. Yeah.
Well, the answer to that, by the late 19th century, they were horrible. But just let me preface that a bit. It depended a lot on the particular czar, because the czars were all powerful. So if you could get an all-powerful leader who had a compassionate streak, such as Alexander II, who was the czar through much of the novel that I'm writing. So conditions were actually getting better for the Jews beginning in about 1860, because before him, there was a czar, Nicholas I, who was conscripting children as young as 12, and kids as young as 6 were being kidnapped from their families. And each town had to come up with a quota for the Tsar's army. And the real motivation behind that was to convert the kids to Christianity. Many of them never lived to their 18th birthday. And then when they turned 18, they had to serve 25 years in the army. So like I say, there are some things about the 19th century that we should not miss. But things did improve under Alexander II. He freed the serfs but gave them no means for a livelihood. His attitude was liberate people from above so they don't rebel from below. And he was much more compassionate towards the Jews. He gave them limited rights. More could go to school, more could reside in Russia if they had certain skills. He stopped the conscription of children. So things were actually looking up, and he was somewhat popular among the Jews. And then, like often happens in these autocratic regimes, they start letting off the gas a little bit, and people say, hey, we like this liberty thing. We want more of it. And then they try and clamp down again, and then there's more rebellion. They clamp down harder, more rebellion. And finally, there was a group, the revolutionary group started to rise up, and there was a group called the People's Will that said to him, basically, we're going to assassinate you, and there's nothing you can do about it. And indeed, after 5 attempts, which is an interesting story in itself, they did assassinate him. And one of the assassins, not one of the core members, but one of the secondary participants, was a Jewish woman named Gessia Gelfman. She was a real historical figure. Mm-hmm. So in 1881, in March, when he's assassinated, and they learned that one of them is a Jew, that basically the Jews are blamed for the assassination. And then pogroms, which are, violent mob, outbursts against the Jews, broke loose in Ukraine, all over Ukraine, basically. So things really started getting bad. It was considered a sudden turn in Jewish history in 1881. And then 1882, they got even worse because the Jews were blamed for the pogroms, and the May Laws came along. They're called the May Laws because I guess they were instituted in May. And they were supposed to be temporary, but they never went away. And they basically had restrictions on what Jews could and couldn't do, even within the Pale of Settlement. So once you start treating any group with special laws and so on, that's a pretty dramatic downward slope. And things just kept getting worse throughout that period. And that's when the great migration of Jews from Russia began. So
right.
Between 1880 or 1881 and 1914, 1.5 million Jews came to America, and many, if not the majority of Jews in America could trace their ancestry back to that period of time, at least almost everybody I've met who's Jewish. In that same time period, there were 20 million immigrants who came to the United States. Imagine that, Rick, 20 million. Mm-hmm. At the time that we had a population of 75 million. Right? And
right.
You compare that to happening at our southern border, and you realize that the southern border refugees who are trying to escape violence in their own country and find a better life, just as the Jews did in the 19th century, that they're a very small group. I mean, I think there was people on the one side of the political spectrum were totally freaking out about them. What they called a horde of 10,000 people. Well, you know, there were 650,000 people a year coming into our country back in that time period I mentioned, when we had a much, much smaller population.
Mm. And so we talked about the conditions for Jews. Tell us, you know, about the conditions for women at that time.
So women had a double whammy. One, they had no rights virtually in the Russian Empire. Although, again, under Tsar Alexander II, for a while, things improved. And then, like I said, there's that you loosen up things and then you pull back, right? They were allowed to go to college, then they were university, and then that was pulled back. So they had that. And then within the Jewish faith, you know, only boys went to school, you know. And so the girls learned at home from their mothers or from a tutor. I think there were some girls' schools at the time, but they were few. I certainly have one in the novel, but they were few and far between. And, you know, not every girl got to go. So there was that. And then, you know, they had no rights to property. I don't think it was that much different than women in America.
Yeah. It's interesting that you think about the time period. I think your book starts in the 1860s. And so I'm thinking, what else was going on? Oh, the Civil War was going on in the U.S. So it's interesting to put things in perspective of what's happening around the world at the same time. Now, I understand this book took you about 6 years to complete. So what does it take, Michael, to write a novel?
Well, I think the number one thing is probably to have a passion for your subject. Because I think if you do, that's going to come through. I think the writing skill and the style, I think that can be developed. You join a good group like the Burlington Writers Workshop, or you take a writing class. But if you don't love your subject, that's not going to work out well. So I think you have to start out with something compelling, a compelling story. That would be my number one thing. And then I think a lot of determination. You can't, it's not going to happen overnight. So if you're an impatient person, you're probably not going to write a novel.
Gotcha.
You're going to have a lot of rewrites and a lot of changes as you go along.
Yeah.
Now, I approached it as I did not start with an outline. So there are two basic ways to approach, I think, a novel or a big writing project. Is you outline everything, you do all your research ahead of time. And that's certainly a valid approach. And I suspect that, you know, somebody like George Eliot, who wrote Middlemarch, must have done that approach. There's no way you could just sit down and write that novel with such a complex plot that weaves in and out like that without having, I mean, I don't think so, but I could be wrong in her case. But and then the other way is to just let the, you know, just put a flashlight on the character's forehead and just you're right there and see what they do and just start developing those characters. And then the plot will come in. And then I think there's a combination of those two approaches. And I was probably started out with the character approach. Who are these people? You know, what are their problems? What are their what do they want? And from there, I started pulling in more of what was going on to the time period. What would have been, because you want to put your characters in impossible situations. Because if I don't think a book about somebody who didn't want anything and had everything they needed and had a comfortable life would be a very interesting book unless right. something went terribly wrong with them.
Yeah. Sounds like you used the architectural movement that was founded here in Vermont, the design build movement, in writing this book. Michael, we've got about a minute left, but I want you to tell us about the cover art of the book, Hurrah, No Burning.
Sure. Well, the cover art is an image of a painting by Marc Chagall, who was a painter of Jewish ancestry, and he grew up in the Pale Settlement. In a town about, I'd say, 200 miles from Hrodno. And much of his work, particularly his early work, was inspired by his early years in the Pale Settlement. And the painting I used, or his painting that I chose, was is called Flying Carriage. And it, I think for me, it portrays both the trauma and transcendence that are common themes in throughout Jewish history. So I was very lucky to get the rights to use that image. I've heard many people comment on that.
Yeah. Very quickly, working on anything for the next book?
Well, because I've been in edit mode for about, like I said, at least two years, mm-hmm. I felt I needed some support to get going on the next novel. So I signed up for a novel in a year class, which is kind of a joke because it's probably a novel in a year and then 7 years of editing. But who I am in a year.
All right.
Actually, January 1st.
Good luck, Michael. Michael Friedthal is the author of Hurrah, No Burning. It's published by Rootstock Publishing, and their website is rootstockpublishing.com. Michael, thank you so much for telling us about Hurrah, No Burning this morning.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care. While we take a break, we're going to next up meet a very interesting Vermonter. This one throws boomerangs, and he throws them very, very well. And listen today on WDEV for the afternoon news service beginning at 4 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our rockin' deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Last week, I had Tad Coffin on the show, a Vermonter who is a two-time gold medal winner in equestrian eventing and who produces incredible riding saddles. At the end of the interview, he gave me a special gift. He said, "The person you really need to have on your show is Eric Darnell." Not to get too punny, but I never look a gift horse in the mouth. I found Eric Darnell in Stratford and realized that Tad Coffin was, again, very right. Eric Darnell is an 8-time world boomerang champion. I'm not even sure what that means. And he holds 30 patents. I understand that, and I'm mightily impressed. So for the next hour, we're going to learn about this fascinating Vermonter. Eric Darnell, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, if you've got questions about boomerangs or patents and you want Eric to answer them, give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email VTViewpoint at RadioVermont.com. Eric, when did you discover you had a love for the boomerang?
I was actually about 12. And I grew up with heavy bouts of asthma, and so I spent a lot of time with books because that was I didn't have to move around much to read them. And we had a huge encyclopedia at home, and I was cruising through it and got into looking at boomerangs. And thought, well, I've been making gliders since I could crawl because our family was always very much interested in airplanes and so on. My father had a license for a private plane, et cetera. And so I decided, well, I can make boomerangs. It's just two wings put together. And so I tried, and at that point in time, there wasn't very good wood to use, plywood. It was three-ply quarter inch. By the time we carved a wing, it was not much of the lamination left, so they broke easily. But it took me actually quite a while to get a boomerang to work well because I kept trying to make the same wing profiles that I made for the gliders. And it was not an appropriate profile for boomerangs. And basically, you needed a little more undercut on the leading edges so that they were a little more responsive. But I figured it out and kept making them and made more and more of them and didn't hear about anybody else making any until I was, it was about 1973, I think. And I read about Ben Rue down in Washington, D.C., putting on a tournament sponsored by the Smithsonian. And so I wrote him a letter. It was back before email or anything else, and got back in response about half a ton of information about boomerangs and invited down to the next tournament. Went down and pretty easily won everything because I was the only one that really knew what he was doing because I've been making him for so long. And just started from there. And it's been a wonderful ride. I've been around the world many times and managed to win a few things. And I'm 5 times throwing champion and 3 times coaching champion. So that's that and a couple bucks to get you a cup of coffee anywhere.
I'll buy you a coffee for that. That's fantastic. What are the physics, Eric, that are at work that makes that boomerang, you know, fly so beautifully and then all of a sudden just curve back and come right back to where I threw it?
Well, it's basically lift and spin. Basically, you're launching it not horizontally like a Frisbee, but almost vertically. And so the direction of the lift is 90 degrees to the wing, which puts it not quite on a horizontal plane to the way you threw it, but a slight angle up, and that you need for supporting the weight of the boomerang. And so you're throwing it to the right of the wind if you're right-handed, and to the left of the wind if you're left-handed, because the wind helps it come back. And you're launching it out there, and the gyroscopic precession is creating the lift that brings it back around.
Now, I was asked this question earlier. Were they originally intended for hunting?
Apparently, they had a dual development with the throwing sticks, the Kalaeli ukulele, which was the actual hunting weapon, which was not designed to return. The boomerangs were more used in ceremonial purposes, except in northern Queensland, which is all boggy and swamps and full of migrating birds. And so the Aborigines would throw a boomerang out behind a flock of birds and make a noise like the local hawk, which is a huge 6-foot wingspan hawk. And the birds would dive down into nets that the Aborigines had set up, and hopefully your boomerang would come back out of the swamp because Mr. Croc lived in the swamp, and you didn't want to go wading in looking for your boomerang that would have sunk because they were heavy wood in the swamp. So if it worked well, the boomerang did its job and came back out, and you were able to retrieve it.
Mr. Croc, we want to stay away from him. Now, you mentioned that you know, the boomerang, I think you throw it almost like not straight overhead, but with a little bit of an angle, but certainly not horizontal. Explain exactly, you know, the best way, and I don't think you throw it straight up, which a lot of people tend to when they get a...
No, you throw it, if you're in an open field, throw it towards the top of the trees in the distance at the edge of the field. Mm-hmm. Would be about the right angle above the horizon. But basically, if you threw it horizontally like a Frisbee, it would go straight up like an airplane taking off going down a runway and then come down who knows where. So that's not what you want to do. When I'm teaching kids, I have foam boomerangs that I teach them with first before they're allowed to throw the plastic ones and or wooden ones. And a lot of the boys never graduate to the hard plastic or wooden ones because they don't listen, and they just want to throw it as hard as they can, whereas the girls listen, and they throw it properly and get to graduate and have a good time.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, you went down to Washington for this competition. How old were you when you did that?
I was 30.
Oh, really? So yep. Was there a point, though, before that that you realized you were actually rather outstanding at boomeranging?
Well, I like I said, I've been making them since I was 12, so I knew pretty much what I was doing. I was a counselor at a summer camp in California, in Los Alamos Hills, and we had sort of a summer masquerade party, so I decided to go as an Aborigine because I've been teaching the kids how to make boomerangs. So I went and covered myself with ash, including in my hair and everything, from a fire pit, and showed up in wearing shorts and covered with ash. And the leader of the camp was incredibly disappointed in me of setting an incredibly bad example of proper hygiene, et cetera, because I really did look like a mess, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I was pretty good with them, and so it was fun to go down to Washington and help evolve the sport and help evolve a lot of the events that were contested, because there really weren't too many in the beginning. I mean, everybody just was able to barely throw it and catch it.
Well, when you showed up at a camp like that and started throwing a boomerang, you had to be kind of an oddity. I don't know, a curiosity, I'll say. Was it well accepted, or did people say, stay away from the guy with the boomerang?
No, it was more like a magnet that people flocking to. I mean, a boomerang is magic. You throw it away from yourself as hard as you can, and it comes back. It defies the laws of physics, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it doesn't. But, you know, people are just amazed that this thing will come back. That's the fun part to me, is because it's kind of unique as a sport, because you are the target, and you're competing against yourself and against the elements more than somebody else. So it's really kind of fun, because you can really applaud somebody that beat you, or commiserate with somebody that had bad luck. The Australians say it's either a great throw or bad luck. They don't even talk about a bad throw. They just enjoy the sport. In 1981, I was part of a large contingent that went down under and beat the Aussies in the first ever international boomerang tournament. And there was headlines in the Sydney paper, a great disaster for the Aussie nation, and or for the Aboriginal nation. And I was thinking, there weren't any Aborigines on the team. It was all British descendants, which I am as well, so I wasn't sure that was the appropriate title for it. But if we hadn't beaten them, there probably wouldn't have ever developed much of an international interest. But since we did, it really sprung up, and we had tournaments all over the place, and two or three a year internationally, and it was really, really fun. I mean, I've been all over Europe. I have friends all over the world for boomerangs, which is really a treat.
Yeah. Eric, these boomerang competitions, what am I talking about here? Are there rules, scoring? Is individual different from team? How does it work?
Well, most of them are individual, although the international ones are team, and they also have individual events in the same venue. But there's different events, such as fast catch, where you throw and catch one boomerang five times as quick as you can, and it has to go 20 meters before it comes back. And the current record is somewhere around 14 seconds for five throws and catches, which is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's maximum time aloft, which is how long you can put a boomerang up in the air and catch it, all within a 100-meter circle, which sounds big, but it looks pretty small when you have a boomerang up there hovering 150 feet above you. And I actually had that record for about 13 years, about a minute and 45 seconds in the air with a catch. And then there's the classic Australian round where you get points for distance, points for accuracy, and points for a catch. You're standing in the middle of concentric rings like a bullseye, and you throw it out, and you get points up to 50 meters and an accurate return. So maximum points is 100, and nobody's actually ever done that, but it's because the wind is a variable. There are many, many variables involved in throwing a boomerang. And team events, you have a team relay where you have one person run in, or two teams competing against each other, and they both run into the same bullseye and throw and catch and run back and tag their teammate, and they go in and you go through the line of four throwers twice and see who comes out on top. Then there's accuracy, which is one of the more frustrating ones, because you throw and you try to bring it back to the same bullseye as like the Aussie round, but you're not allowed to touch it. And so that's very frustrating, because interacting with the boomerang is what's really all about, in my opinion.
Right.
It makes it more fun.
Yeah. Let's go to Bethel. We've got Robert on the line. Hi, Robert. Go right ahead.
Hey, Rick.
Hey.
Eric, how are you, my friend?
I'm good. How are you?
Nice to hear you talking about boomerangs. Hey, Rick and audience, I always think of Eric as the reincarnated Leonardo da Vinci.
Why is that, Robert?
Well, I think he'll surprise you with some other things.
Okay.
He's incredibly innovative and very properly spoken, and he's got some really good things coming on.
Anything in particular you want to tease us with and we can ask Eric about?
Well, I believe that he might talk about an invention and a design that could transform the entire ski industry. And I believe he will bring that up. It's an incredible product, and Eric designed everything, patented everything.
Are these the snow gliders you're talking about? Is this snow gliders, or is this something else you're talking about, Robert?
Well, I actually, in my home, I have wood stoves that Eric designed back when Vermont Castings was innovating their product, and Eric had a different philosophy. And the wood stoves in my home are the best wood stoves that man could want. I'm sure he'll talk about them.
Yeah, we're going to get to all his patents and inventions. But, Robert, thanks for teeing that up. I want to finish up a little bit on boomerangs, and then after the top of the hour, Eric, if you don't mind, we'll go into your inventions. But you mentioned this a little bit earlier when you know the Americans went down to Australia and won the world boomerang title from the Aussies, and I gotta imagine that was like the Aussies winning the America's Cup in sailing, right? It had to be a little bit, not embarrassing, but kind of a shocking moment.
It was a shock. It definitely was. Not expected at all. We prevailed quite honestly by being a better team. We worked better together. They were on their home turf, which is never an advantage for a sport, because you tend to get into your own little ego-centered whatever. And so they really were infighting a little more than they would do well with, and so we were able to prevail.
And you were, I think, helping each other with wind speed and direction, and so you kept other team members.
And equipment, yep.
And equipment, yeah.
The Aussies wouldn't throw each other's boomerangs, and I've always been sort of provider of the boomerangs to people, and I would watch somebody warming up and could see that what they were using wasn't going to work very well for the conditions we were in, and I would make suggestions and or change the boomerang for them and get a better performance, and that's how a team wins.
We got a minute before the break, Eric, but you also do this thing where you put an apple on top of your head, throw the boomerang. Well, tell people what you do.
Well, it's William Tell without the kid. I put an apple on my head and throw a boomerang out and come back and have it slice the apple in two. And I've done it for years and years, and I'd always pre-slice the apple just to have the boomerang nudge it to break it in two.
Ah.
But I did a ad for Nike, and they were using an 8,000th shutter speed camera, so we couldn't do that because it would show the toothpicks that I used to hold the apple together. So I actually had to sharpen a boomerang and have it go out and come back and actually slice the apple, which led to some migraine headaches, et cetera, et cetera. From
Oh, my gosh.
Hit in the head as well.
Eric. All right, we're going to take a break. Yeah, well done. You impress me so much. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then we'll be back with Eric Darnell. We're going to talk next about his patents, a lot of things he's invented. If you'd like to ask Eric about boomerangs or his fascinating life, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Today at 1 o'clock, it's Travels with Charlie, hosted by Charlie Papillo. That's followed by 2 hours of great music on The Getaway with the maestro, Mr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Eric Darnell is my guest. This is a man who owns 30 patents, and he is an 8-time boomerang world champion, 5 times as a thrower, 3 times as a coach. And until this morning, you didn't even know that that was a thing, but it is. Eric is with me, and if you'd like to ask him about his fascinating career, his inventions, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So we're going to get to your 30 patents. Let's start with your schooling. Eric, what kind of student were you growing up?
I had an abysmal time in high school. I went to a very good Quaker boarding school in Pennsylvania, West Town, 30 miles west of Philadelphia. And I just wasn't a good fit for academics. I'm heavily dyslexic, and I had a great deal of difficulty with being able to spell, and the whole thing was a disaster. The good news is I had two teachers that got me. One was a physics teacher that said, you understand how things work. That's a gift that not many people have, and you really should work on that. And the other was a art instructor that realized I wasn't a fine artist. I couldn't draw anything to save my soul, but I was a sculptor, and that sculpting really held me in good stead through my whole career. But schooling was a real disaster. I finally braced myself. I was living in California by then, and went to UC Berkeley and actually graduated with honors. And what changed was that I could write a paper and then have somebody type it and correct all my spelling and structure and everything else and get an A out of it. And in exchange, I would tune their VW bug or something. I was a street mechanic in college. Wow. I was a diesel mechanic for 4 years before that, so I had a little instruction in how things worked in that field.
What was your degree in out of Berkeley, which is impressive?
CNR, Conservation of Natural Resources.
Oh, interesting.
I was basically trained to be a regional planner, and my first job was actually working on the Bay Area Regional Plan out of a Claremont Hotel in Oakland. But it really didn't pan out very well, and I walked away in disgust because all they were doing was looking at how to accommodate growth. Mm-hmm. For example, this new system, BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, was just starting up, and so people were looking at where it was going to go and trying desperately to buy up all the real estate, which was going to, you know, increase in value rapidly when BART showed up.
Right.
Water was a big resource that I worked on, and it was obvious that there wasn't going to be enough water for the expanded growth that everybody thought was going to come along. So it was, the whole thing was a disaster in terms of really planning. So then I moved to the Upper Valley here in the White River area. And the first thing I noticed was there was an abysmal intersection in West Lebanon where the shopping plazas are. And at that point, there weren't there wasn't the Seven Brew Hub, et cetera, et cetera. And so I drew in a clover leaf and sent it to the local paper and also to the state. And they both came back and said, oh, this will never happen. You'd have to get the state and the federal and everybody to agree to it. And that would take forever, and it would never go through. So it never happened. But it would have made a much nicer intersection there if that clover leaf had gone in. Oh. But anyway, meantime, I had to make a living. So I was a carpenter and a welder and a mechanic just to make ends meet.
Well, even before you got to high school and Berkeley, didn't your parents realize that you had that mechanical mind early on?
They did. The dyslexia wasn't discovered, wasn't identified until I was about 30, so that was late coming. But they did know that I had a strong aptitude for mechanical things. I bought my first car when I was 12, which was a Model A station wagon that basically had no wooden body left, but just had a cowling over the engine, and I built a little cockpit to drive in. But my fun was tinkering with the engine and drivetrain and everything and keeping it running order, and that was a lot of fun.
You remind me so much of my grandfather, who had a sixth-grade education but was a genius when it came to things like that, and he once converted a lawnmower into a snowblower. I think he read how to do it in Popular Mechanics and just
nice.
Did it, right. So what was your first invention, Eric?
Well, I guess you could say my boomerangs were. I mean, I do have patents for my boomerang designs, but way back then I was just making them. But my first invention probably was my wood-burning stove, the free-flow stove. That I invented in 1974, and it's still manufactured in Germany, and there's at least 20 copies now made in mostly the Eastern Bloc of Czech Republic and Poland, etc. And over there it's called a bullerjan, which is means big heat, because in Europe you're not allowed to use a name on a product that's descriptive of what it does, and the free-flow stove is unique in that it distributes the heat that it produces using the fire's heat as the blower. And so you're not allowed to use that in Europe. So they came up with bullerjan.
How did you develop that?
Well, I was living in a converted chicken coop, 10 by 20, which I called my ship's cabin on the Sea of Life. And it was big for a ship's cabin, and it just was very comfortable, except the wood-burning stove that I had was horrible, and would either had a control on it that either turned the whole thing cherry red or go out in the middle of the night, so neither one was good. And at that point, I was making fireplace tubes for people that they could put in inserts in there, and I was designing them so they didn't need blowers, so that they were the size of the tubing and the spacing of the tubing allowed for a good convection. And I had the idea of why not put two sets of them together in opposition and like interdigitated fingers. And then you'd have something and put in a baffle like they use in the Scandinavian stoves. So you have control over the burn and you'd have a pretty good heater. So I went to Ted Coffin's father, Ned Coffin, and asked him to borrow the money to do that, because I had the idea on a trip to the West Coast, and I came back with no money, and I had a job as a carpenter, but I wanted to make this thing right away. So he lent me $120 to buy the materials, and I welded on this thing at night while I was a carpenter during the day and got it done and fired it up and changed my life. It just was wonderful that you could go to bed with it 70 and wake up with it 70. And it just was incredible. And then I had the most painful month of my life where I was lending it to people with real houses to try, and I took whatever they'd been using in exchange, and it just was, I've been spoiled rotten already, so I couldn't wait to get my free flow back and be comfortable again.
Did you produce free flows then, or did you sell the patent idea?
I produced the first 200. First, what I did was went down to Organic Gardening Magazine in Pennsylvania, was interested in selling them. So I went down and was going to set up a production for them, and then somebody realized that if they produced their own stove, that they would lose the revenue from the 16 other stove manufacturers that advertised in their magazines. So they decided after I was there for 3 months that they didn't want to produce it anymore, and so turned me loose.
Oh, boy. I think we lost. Are you there, Eric? All right. Let's take a break. We're going to go to our last break and then try to get Eric back. Sounds like we lost him one more time. Eric, your next invention has got to be a foolproof cellular phone system that works in Vermont. But I think you could spend the rest of your life trying to figure that one out.
Well, I'm on a landline and it's still not working well.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now you know, you have your work cut out for you for the next few years. All right.
Anyway, we need to get moving here. So I built the first 200 stoves here and then licensed a company in Canada who licensed a company in Germany, and the rest is history. People can look them up on Google them and all that. And then the next thing I really worked on was the lacrosse helmets. I changed the style of the lacrosse helmet in 1993 to the modern helmet, and over 90% of the kids wear my helmets. And that was for Cascade helmets. And then I'm very proud to invent the first women's goggles, wire goggles, for lacrosse that really, really, really made a difference.
That's incredible. I see them play with those. I had no idea that was, you know, our Vermonter, Eric Darnell, who created that.
Yep. It was a long effort. It took me 3 years going to the NCAA women's meetings to convince them that the wire was the appropriate material to use so that the kids could play in all conditions and not be a detriment if it was raining or cold or too sunny, et cetera, which they were using the polycarbonate goggles before. And so that really changed things for the better.
Wow.
But the latest invention, which is one that Robert called snow gliders, is something that's unfortunately been interrupted by the pandemic and the inability to go to trade shows, et cetera. And this is something that's a cross between a cross-country ski and a snowshoe. And it lets you kick and glide just like you're on cross-country skis, has step-in bindings like a backcountry ski boot, so it's easy to just click and go. And that's a huge asset to somebody who's geriatric and can't bend down and do the snowshoe stuff anymore.
Right.
But they're just much more efficient than the snowshoes. And they're nice and stable. They're 8 inches wide, and so they're nice and stable. And they have cleats that ratchet down, so you go straight up a hill. I actually use the cleats for going down a hill to keep from over-speeding so that I'm happy going up and down as well. Mm. And so I'm still hopeful to get them out there somehow. But the good old boy network of the ski industry is a tough one to crack, and they see me as threatening to take market share away from them. And, in fact, what I'm trying to do is find a manufacturer somewhere to license to manufacture and sell so they would profit from it, not lose market share.
Right. It's a completely different product than what they're selling, so it would expand the market in your estimation.
And that's a plus and a minus.
Yeah.
Like L.L. Bean says, they want them as soon as they're discovered, in quotes. But they don't want to be the one that has to put them out there first to see if people like them.
Yeah.
And REI expressed interest as well. But, again, they don't want to be the first people out there. They want them to be already flooding the market, and then they'll take them on.
Wow. All right.
So it's tough.
Yeah. Let's talk to Mark. He's joining us from Middlesex. Hi, Mark. Go right ahead.
I'm wondering what the best way is to gain a patent. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, once you put your idea out there, then it's free game. Seems like there's a lot of hawks out there. I had one stolen a while back, there was a tubing tool that would cut off the tubing from the fitting. The fittings are all standard, you know, ribbed fittings for vacuum. So if you cut the tubing off with a regular knife, you're going to score those ribs, and then, you know, potentially get a vacuum leak. But this tool, you know, was to cut it off without doing that. And so I go to the farm show, and there's a guy there that makes tubing tools, and I guess somebody talked to somebody else, and there it was, you know.
Yeah.
Well, he saw me coming and got out of the booth and headed out, but I was going to congratulate him on it. You know, I'm not in it for the money. It's, you know, just to get stuff out there. And But
well,
yeah,
it got out there, but not the way you want it. Mark, thanks for that question.
I didn't tell him the rest of the story either, you know, the rest of the tool, but
yeah.
Whoever I talk to, I don't know. But
all right, well, let's get an answer from Eric on, you know, to make sure that you're protected. What is the way to get something patented, and at what point do you go?
Do it. You need a good attorney to do a good patent search, number one.
Yep.
And you're talking for a patent somewhere north of $15,000 to $20,000 for a good patent. So it's not cheap, but you put all that in place before you show it to people.
Yep.
And so it's a lot of research and money spent with having nothing in return. And I certainly haven't. I've got over 120,000 tied up in the snow gliders that is not, I haven't seen it, you know, any profit from that whatsoever, and
yeah.
Don't expect to until they're on the market. So you have to be willing to go through that first to get something out there.
Yeah. Certainly, it's a long road, Mark, from here to there when you have an idea. And the best thing to do is not tell too many people about it until you can get it to market. When I mentioned earlier the guest I had on Thursday, that was Tad Coffin. He makes these innovative saddles. He credits you with his getting into the business. Can you tell us that story?
Well, his father, again, is Ned Coffin. It was Ned Coffin who's passed, but he's a dear friend of mine for 40 years. And he let me know that Tad was having trouble with saddles, and Tad's a phenomenal rider, and he was breaking saddles left, right, and center, the best saddles in the world. So I asked Tad to bring him up three samples of his favorite saddles that he'd broken, and by broken meaning they wouldn't perform the way they were supposed to anymore. So we brought them up, and we took them apart. We found the same problem in all three in terms of how they were designed, and so we put together a modified one that was modified in the way I thought would correct the problem, and Tad took it home and rode on it for a year and couldn't break it, so we decided, that's interesting, and so they decided maybe we should get in the saddle business, and so we put together set up a facility down at Tad's place and got a production line going and got the first samples done, and then sent them to England to be covered with leather. And the English people over there sent them back and said, "This is not how you make a saddle. We won't cover it." So, because it wasn't the way a traditional saddle was being made.
Right.
So Tad had to learn how to do all the leather work as well, and he's become an expert at that, as well as making good saddles. They're beautiful as well. You can go to their website and Tad Coffin Performance Saddles and look at how beautiful they are. So that was very rewarding for me, and also that Tad was such an amazing student. I think I mentioned talking to you earlier, Rick, that his father's toolbox consisted of a screwdriver and a hammer and a chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
So Tad didn't have much of a experience with using a lot of tools, but I taught him a lot of different things of how to use different tools, and he was phenomenal in learning. And just, I'm incredibly impressed with what he's done. He was just, he's a brilliant, brilliant person.
Yeah. Now, snow gliders is the one thing you have going right now. Are you working on other inventions? None that I really need you to mention in too much detail so that somebody else doesn't run off with the idea. But, I mean, are you always kind of tinkering and trying to figure out the next thing that you might get
yep.
patented?
Yep. I would like to do a different way of solar collection. We have a very, very nice solar array here made by Solarflex, which is a local company, but I'm still appalled at the amount of resource used for the amount of energy gained, and I still think there's a more efficient way to go about the whole thing of getting solar voltaics working, and so I would like to work on that. That would be my next major project, and that's a big one.
Yeah. Isn't your home in South Stratford designed in a particularly innovative way as well, Eric?
That was a former home I had.
Okay.
It was an octagon, post-and-beam octagon, which I designed and worked very well with passive solar. The current house I'm in is a renovated 1830s house with an extension on it. So I wouldn't call it very innovative, but it's innovative in that we have the solar array and the Tesla wall, too, in the basement for solar backup, so we're in good shape on that. And we have a new electric car, which we can charge at home, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
The house itself is not that innovative, no.
Okay. And I think another invention, you said you've patented a number of your boomerangs. Isn't one of yours that's on the market the Tri-Fly boomerang?
Yep. That's the most popular. You can go to a boomerang tournament anywhere in the world, and somebody will be throwing a Tri-Fly. It's that popular. I've sold 1.5 million of those so far.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's a three-winged design that has bulbous tips, and it took me 15 years to design it. What I was trying to do is come up with something that could be ambidextrous, which is a fascination of mine, and could be lighter than the traditional boomerang but handle wind conditions better than the traditional boomerang. And so I came up with this as under camber, hollowed out under the wings, and only weighs about 43 grams in the polypropylene version, and will handle wind better than a regular two-wing boomerang that's twice that weight. Being ambidextrous is great. And it's also not using airfoils. It's more mimicking a turbine blade shape, it has not only lift built in by twisting the wings to create positive angle attack, but also drag so that it slows down when it comes back to you and makes it easier to catch. So it's quite an innovative design.
Brilliant. Oh, my gosh. Wow. Eric Darnell of Stratford is an 8-time world boomerang champion. He holds 30 patents, and is an absolute pleasure getting to know you and hearing about your lifetime of accomplishments, Eric. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you.
All right. You take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update. Then we'll be back to talk with Senator Patrick Leahy. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. When the announcement came last Monday, I was a bit surprised. He's only been on the job for 46 years, and I think he was really starting to get the hang of it. To be fair, the longest that I've ever lasted in a job was 12 years, and I didn't have to convince half the state of Vermont, plus one, to send me back to it. When he leaves office at the end of his eighth term, he'll have more than deserved time to relax on the farm in Middlesex and spend time with Marcel. Joining us now to discuss the decision, the future, and yes, the job we're still paying them to do is Senator Patrick Leahy. Senator, thank you for being with us and congratulations on your decision.
Well, thank you, Vic. I appreciate that. And no, there is still a lot to be done. In fact, I'm spending much of this week working on appropriations matters so we can finish up the budget for the year. And, of course, I joked with somebody that is chairman of the Appropriations Committee. I do it very, very, in a very fair way. I take the states alphabetically, starting with V, Vermont, and at which point one of the senators from Virginia represent. I like that.
That's right.
but the thing is, it's I've appreciated the opportunity to represent Vermont. I remember as a little boy telling my grandparents, who's asked what I might want to do, and said it'd be nice to be a senator someday. And my Italian grandfather and with a thick accent said that, Senatore, that's good for you. Well, wow. Of course, then going to law school and at Georgetown, spending time walking up and down the hill, coming back and being first in private practice and having four terms as state's attorney, I never thought I would be there, but I've been so proud to be there and represent Vermont. I can't think of enjoying the job anywhere near as much representing any state other than Vermont.
Yeah, and you should mention undergrad, a proud graduate of St. Michael's College here in Vermont. Listeners, if you'd like to speak with Senator Leahy, our number is 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Senator, any chance you've had a rethink and want to take this opportunity right now to reverse your decision and decide to run next year?
Well, Rick, that might cause a bit of a headline, but no. This was, I grew up in Montpelier, and I picked the room in the State House. That's where I announced when I first ran, and that's also where I announced my retirement. My sister Mary was there for both, and of course Marcel and I, first time when our parents were still alive, and our children were there. Now we have children and grandchildren, but no, I kind of looked at a couple polls that said I'd easily win re-election, but I said I didn't really want to consider whether I'd win re-election or not. It's whether this was a good time to leave when I was at the top of my game. And we walked around our fields and woods in Middlesex, talked about it among the family, and I'm very, very comfortable with the decision. I'm proud of what I've been able to do for Vermont and the nation and the world. And I can leave proud that I've done the job I said I would do. And no second thoughts. I can watch all the elections next year with a calm detachment of a political science, which is what, incidentally, you mentioned St. Michael's. That's what I majored in, St. Mike's, back at an interesting time when we used to hitchhike back and forth to school. I do remember my parents saying, they'd sometimes drive me back there. They said, couldn't I have started school at St. Michael's after they built the interstate? I think they had it about the last year I was in college. It was a little bit easier trip.
Oh, my. Well, starting out in that campaign back in 1974, did you have any idea that you'd serve so many years in the Senate, that this would be from that point forward, your career?
No, I honestly didn't. I still, about the only things I've saved from press and framed in my office are two headlines. That first election, one big bold type front page the paper says, "Poll dooms Leahy." The next one, 5 days later, says, "Leahy unexpectedly wins." Well, I knew that I came there, it may be just one term, but I was going to do the most I could with it. The majority view in Vermont was to support the war in Vietnam. It'd be hard to find anybody with that view today. And within 2 or 3 months, I had to be the deciding vote in a committee to cut off support for the war in Vietnam, and did. And I realized that a lot, and with only 100 senators, a lot of things depend on just one vote, one way or the other. And I was going to make my vote count. And that's what I've tried to do since, almost 17,000 times.
Wow. Well, we should mention that in that that election back in 1974, one of the opponents that you beat was a guy named Bernie Sanders. And so it's funny to look back on that now with the two of you serving in the Senate together. Do you lord that over him at, you know, all these years later?
No, no, he sometimes jokes about it, because obviously when he was in there as a third-party candidate, most of his votes came from me and not from my opponent. And he could have elected the Republican. But I think he honestly felt that I had no way of winning, and he wanted to get his name known. He knew that he couldn't win, and so he ran. But no, we worked together. We're a set of partners, and we'll continue to work together to the day I leave.
Fantastic. Now, we did hear this morning Peter Welch has announced that he will run for your seat. What are your thoughts about that, Senator?
Well, Peter's a friend, and he's obviously a strong candidate for the Senate. I've enjoyed working with him for years. And Vermonters will make that decision. You know, we Vermonters know who we're looking for, and I trust them. And we're going to have race for the House and the Senate in the primary election. I will strongly support the Democrat who's nominated, both for the House and for the Senate. We can't be diluting the vote among multiple candidates, I don't believe, because look at the Senate. It's a 50-50 Senate. Mm-hmm. One vote, one way or the other, can determine. The people who are, to this day, very, very strong supporters of Donald Trump would like it to go Republican and follow a Trump agenda. I would like to see it follow a more progressive agenda, and one which supports all people. I mean, one of the things I said when I got elected, whether somebody was a Republican or a Democrat, I was there to represent them. Mm-hmm. And whether they had voted for me or voted against me, my door was always open to them. And I've always taken that position. For example, I worked very, very closely with Governor Scott, as I've been able to bring billions of dollars to Vermont during COVID, and to make sure that our state was not devastated by all the losses with COVID. Yeah. And that's the way I feel. When I think of Vermont, I don't care whether people are Republicans or Democrats or independents. I represent them all.
If you don't recognize the voice of this guest, well, you haven't been paying attention to Vermont politics for the past 4.5 decades. Let's go to Charlotte. We've got Meg on the line. Hi, Meg.
Hi, Rick and Senator Leahy. I hope you can hear me. I'm driving suddenly in a poor cell zone. Senator, I just wanted to thank you for all of your years of service to Vermont. And I also, as Rick knows, I'm the director of the Vermont Women's Fund. And I wanted to thank you for the years of the WEOC conference, Women's Economic Opportunity Conference, that you held every year. And in addition to the shout out for that is also to Marcel, who is an incredible person and role model as a working partner with you. And I just have had tremendous admiration for both of you and all you've done. So thank you.
Meg Smith, thank you so much.
Senator? I appreciate that. And don't worry about bad cell zones. the dirt road I live on in Middlesex, I sometimes feel I have to stand 1 foot on the couch, a shoulder against a wall, holding the phone at a certain angle to get any kind of a signal. But thank you for what you said about the Women's Economic Conference. Both Marcel and I have worked on that every year for decades, and I will again next year before I leave. I've heard from so many women that found going there, they end up getting better jobs. It helped them in their careers. They learned a lot. And we've had some wonderful people who have spoken to the conference. So it's something I look forward to every year. This year we had to do it virtually because of COVID. I hope we can be back to doing it in reality. And, you know, it's women have to be empowered throughout our state. I made sure that the Vermont had the first woman federal judge in Vermont, with Judge Rice, and the first woman to be the Vermont judge on the U.S. Second Circuit with Judge Robinson, as I did the first recommend the first woman as U.S. attorney. And fortunately, Vermont pays attention to those things. But thank you for what you said. And none of this could I have done without Marcel. As somebody said, well, we can talk to you, but this is really important. We'd rather talk to the nurse.
All right, let's take another call. Jim's joining us from Barrytown. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
Hey, I'd like to ask about the congressional record. It's kind of like the diary there in D.C. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to when I was a younger musician. I was recording my first rock and roll album here in Vermont, in Brattleboro, and a artist named Ron Slayton approached me. Tom, of course, was the editor of Vermont Life for quite a while.
Right.
And as a musician, Ron approached me to do a soundtrack, a musical soundtrack, and compose it to something called The Rock and the Spark. So, Patrick, it was in the Congressional Record, and my name's in there as a Vermont musician that composed the soundtrack. Is that a cool thing for a guy to have?
Well, you know, I like, as you go through the Congressional Record over the last 47 years now, you find time and time again that Vermonters get recognized in there because I've spoken about them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it might be, sometimes it's something Marcel and I might be in a store in a small town. We just stop to get the paper and somebody comes in and tells us about something someone's done. I get more information. I talk about it on the Senate floor. Now, of course, in this case, it was a very significant thing, but we've had so many Vermonters who I felt should be acknowledged in the Congressional Record, and I do that. And I got to tell you, I burst with pride when I do.
Okay. Well, it should be noted, Jim, I don't know if you know this, he's not a rock star, but Senator Leahy did sing when he was at St. Michael's College, I think in the Glee Club or something. I do want to ask
you. How do you know that? I almost ruined the Glee Club, but, Marcel and I were on Air Force One with President Obama on my birthday. He was actually coming to Vermont, and he surprised me with a birthday cake and sang happy birthday. He has a beautiful voice. And he said, Patrick, do you want to sing too? And Marcel said, if you heard him sing, you would never let him on this plane again.
All right, let's go to Eden this time. We've got Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hey. Pat, like everybody else, I want to thank you for your service. Oh, did you lose me?
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yep.
Okay, good. And the most inspiring thing, I mean, I know you've done so much for so many people in the state, but it was that kind of darkish time in mid-80s. I think it was you and, I don't know, Brock Adams maybe was there, and Ted Kennedy, and you really held the light, you know, when it was dim there for a while, and it was just so heartening. I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you for that. One of the things... After my first election, I said that whether I'm elected or not elected, I would not think of the next election. I'd think about what we're doing. And the Senate, there's only 100 of us to represent the whole country. And I think it should be a conscience of the nation. And at times, whether you're a lone voice or not, speak up for that conscience. I did this in banning landmines, but I also did this in making sure that we had better school lunches for our children and everything in between. And that, the Leahys have been in Vermont since the 1800s. I look at the privilege I had being the first Leahy to get a college degree in my younger sister, the next one. And I think of everything I learned from everybody in Vermont ahead of me and the values I got. And I've just tried to reflect that.
We've got about a minute and a half left. You've got about 14 months left in the Senate. So what will be your priorities, Senator Leahy, in this time you have remaining?
I want to make sure we get our appropriations bills through in a way that reflect the needs of small states and rural needs. But I also want to continue the work I've done worldwide in banning landmines and helping victims of war. Both of these things can be done. There are a lot of other things in between, but neither my staff nor I are going to stop working until the day this term of Senate ends.
All right. I do want to let you know that once you've got nothing to do, you're hanging out there in Middlesex, you're invited. Open invitation anytime you want to come by WDEV and be on Vermont Viewpoint. We'd love to have you on. So.
Oh, and I would enjoy it. If I wasn't dealing with Senate things this week on the budget, I'd be there, and I'd much prefer being there in person.
Fantastic. Senator Patrick Leahy, thank you for all you've done for Vermont, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Take care.
All right, bye now. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. Tomorrow we'll hear from the Vermont Old Cemetery Association, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.